State education officials delay changes to a program to help working families pay for childcare, but providers and families say it's still not enough. More on that, plus an effort to pay tribute to the people and places that make Arkansas's musical heritage stand out. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the Natural State. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. The Arkansas Department of Education is making significant changes to its School Readiness Assistance Program, which helps low-income working families pay for childcare. KUAF's Matthew Moore has the story.
On September 19th, the Education Department hosted a Zoom webinar with early childhood providers to inform them of their decision that would make changes to the reimbursement rate, as well as adjusting the sliding scale copayment rate for families eligible. The changes would go into effect today, October 1st. That's less than 2 weeks' notice. That left childcare providers like Linza Odima Warden scrambling. She's the owner and director at Appletree Academy in Springdale. She says when she told parents about the changes, they told her they would not be able to afford it.
I know for me, in order to be able to compensate my employees, I can't go lower. I can't. Like, this is the lowest that I can go.
Some of those parents include five of her teaching staff, all of whom have more than one child.
I have one parent with two kids here that I believe started applying for vouchers in February whenever the wait list was implemented and has not. Right now, we're at about $6,000 or $7,000. I'm not charging her for that because she's providing a service to our community. And we were told, hey, if you work more than 30 hours or 20 hours and you work at a child care facility and you qualify within this income, then you should be able to get free child care. So we've been reaching out, but we've not been able to get an answer.
The School Readiness Assistant Program provides financial assistance for child care to eligible low-income families while parents work or attend school. The program currently serves more than 16,000 children in Arkansas. The proposed changes include one statewide rate in every county except Washington and Benton, and streamlining the waitlist program that was implemented in February. Previously, families making less than 75% of the state median income, approximately $44,000, qualified for the program with zero copays. Under the new structure, only families making less than 40% of the SMI qualify for zero copays. Nicole Carey is an education policy expert with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. She says it's still not entirely clear how the state will enforce the new standards.
For current families that are participating who can't meet the copayment, and maybe the provider tries to waive it somehow, is the state going to allow them to stay in the program? Because that's another kind of big question mark of the families right now that aren't going to be able to do it. Is the state going to say you aren't complying and kick them out of the program too? Or will that be a potential solution? Which then, of course, is falling on the providers who, based on our childcare model, are already, you know, operating potentially barely within margins as it is. So providers, especially those rural providers, I mean, those relationships that they have with those families, it's going to be so hard to try to then be some type of money enforcement for this state program. And it all is happening so fast.
Linza says expecting parents to pay more out of pocket for childcare is a non-starter.
I've had where some individuals that had even $3 copays, I have to chase them for $3. And for, you know, so for some people, they're like, well, you know, if you have a child, you should be able to provide for them. They are. They're working. they're just stretched thin. Sometimes parents are not able to afford diapers. And so, for example, we had one where for 2 weeks we were buying diapers because mom was just like, I cannot afford it. Then I can't go back and be like, okay, well, since we bought diapers for you, can you, you know, give us diapers back? We can try that, but it's like bleeding, getting blood out of alternative, because a lot of them are going through hardships. We have parents who lose their jobs right when their vouchers end, and they're not able to get vouchers because they don't have a job, but they're not able to get a job because they don't have childcare. And in that situation, we actually, she had two students, and she stayed for a week, and she was not able to pay us for that week as well. So that's cost that we're absorbing, because what am I going to do? Go after her when she literally did try, putting in, going every day, day in and day out, putting out applications.
She says her work is mission-driven. It's a people thing, not a profit thing.
You will see that our prices are lower, but we're doing that intentionally because a lot of the parents in our community are struggling. If you have two or three kids, paying for childcare is rough, especially if you're working at, you know, just a regular job. And so the vouchers are necessary. Right now, that decision, we're not saying there shouldn't be a change. We're asking for more time.
The Department of Education provided a press release and a frequently asked questions Google Doc to providers and the public about the reasons for the changes. In both documents, the agency frames the changes as an opportunity to continue serving as many families as possible while prioritizing families and children most in need of care. But yesterday, Arkansas's Secretary of Education, Jacob Oliva, sat before the Early Childhood Legislative Subcommittee to discuss these changes. It was during this meeting that Secretary Oliva mentions for the first time one of the reasons for the very rapid decision to make these changes: the possibility of a federal government shutdown.
Until we get a budget, we can't plan on spending those dollars. So we had to start immediately really looking over the last few weeks, because these were short notices. And I think a lot of criticism I'm hearing from providers, and it's very warranted, is that they didn't have a lot of time to plan and make some decisions, because we received really short notification that the current revenue and future revenue may look different depending on what our congressional awards are.
Secretary Oliva says another factor in this decision includes an unexpected reduction in some federal funding.
One of the things that we didn't know that was going to happen to us is in this last quarter, when we got our allocation and we get quarterly payments, the formula changed and we had an $8 million reduction that wasn't being anticipated for.
He also says that the current model that we have in Arkansas is unsustainable.
We can't keep funding at that level unless the state or somebody else makes a significant contribution. So right now, if we just said, well, what if we want to leave everything alone and leave it all the same? It's probably about $80 million a year that we would need to invest as a state.
Representative Julie Mayberry, a Republican from Hensley, asked Secretary Oliva when the idea to make these changes first came up. The secretary says about 3 weeks ago, and that this was in part a response to keeping the state agency's budget in mind.
We're not Congress, right? Like, we have to present level, balanced budgets. And I know it's painful and it's not fun, but I think when I talk to the field, they understand that there's probably some adjustments that need to be made. They've asked, like, can we just not do this so quickly? Can we have about 30 days to help process? Let us work with you. Let us look at these amounts. Let us define quality. I'm willing to do that. But I'm willing to do that to make sure this legislature knows that if this government shuts down for another 3 weeks, there's no money to pay these people at all.
Okay. Well, but also going back, so let's just say 3 weeks ago, this is when the idea came up with you and you all became aware of the situation. Was there any phone call or meeting to people who this might greatly affect and say, hey, this is what we're being told. We want to come up with some ideas.
Yeah.
Was there any effort to involve the stakeholders in trying to come up with a solution instead of finding out in 7 days, this is the solution, no ifs, ands, or buts? And
yeah.
I think that's where there's a lot of frustration.
Which is why I'm publicly saying, I hate that we're here. I didn't ask for this. I don't disagree. Do we want to be transparent? Yes. Are there things we can look in the rearview mirror and say, I wish I would have done differently? Which is why we say the windshield is this big, the rearview mirror is this big. These folks want to come to the table and have that conversation. But when you're under the gun to have an October 1 budget, it's hard to get a lot of input. So did we meet with local providers? Did we talk to our team? Did we look at other states? Did we ask as many people as we could? Yes. Is this the perfect solution? No, I'm not disagreeing, but we have to do something.
More than once, Secretary Oliva suggests that it may be possible to pause certain parts of the new changes for 30 days. Representative Stetson Painter, a Republican from Mountain Home, tries to get clarity from the secretary.
I just want to reiterate for the record that you're looking at doing a pause till November 1st with the current rates.
Make sure I state that the right way.
Yeah.
What we're looking at is not changing the reimbursement rates to providers for about 30 days so that we can get them a little bit more comfortable. They are businesses too, and they have contracts. They have payroll. They have been very clear. Like, I feel for the most part, they understand the need to make some adjustments to this program. They just need a little more time and want to have more voice to help make those adjustments. And we're willing to do that. I do think we need to start implementing the sliding scale for copays for families, because we can't just pause this program. We'll run out of money by the end of the month.
Representative Denise Garner, a Democrat from Fayetteville and chair of the Early Childhood Subcommittee, seeks clarification from the secretary as well. She says that she is hearing from parents who still don't know what is going to happen to their vouchers. Secretary Oliva says the Education Department will have to provide more support to child care facilities.
Like I said, if you're under 40% of the threshold, there's not a copay. 40 to 60%, there's a little bit of a copay. Above that, it's a little bit more. If we stay the status quo and don't get a congressional delegation, there will be no money in this pot to give providers.
I get that. I do understand that. I'm just a little bit concerned, a whole lot concerned, actually, that we've given less than a pay period to these parents to figure out how they're going to pay for child care.
Right. And that's why I'm saying,
with the copay that goes up by October 1st.
And I want to work with the providers. I want to work with this delegation. What I'm telling you is, if we don't do something, this pot of money will not have any money in it, and somebody's going to have to fill this pot of money with money from somewhere else. And I don't have the authority to do that.
Where do you find the line between compassion and pragmatism in your work?
It sometimes gets blurred. There's so many outside forces that come in, and so many things that you have to take in. I even have providers sometimes that are like, well, you're not running a charity. But I'm like, you know what? You make a little bit of a difference in this person's life. And hopefully, even if they don't remember it, that still ripples where it goes. Everybody has an agenda, and a lot of the other outside voices come in, and you just have to kind of say which one is going to do the most good and weed out everything. I hope that my response is responsive to you, but it's hard. I think we're a society that's geared towards how is it going to benefit me. We're a society where it's profit, profit, profit. And it's hard for me to say, hey, I'm saying that I want these people to have a voice. I want to advocate for my students. I want to advocate for my workers. I want to advocate for my families, but then I'm going to ask them, hey, let me close for today so that I can go and do that, because it might be just that one mom that may be on her last absence at work and that other employer doesn't care. And so, again, we go back to, we shouldn't have to do all this. We can sit down and say, hey, policymakers, hey, stakeholders, this is what's happening across the state. What can we do?
This morning, Secretary Oliva's office confirmed the changes in rates to the School Readiness Assistance Program would be delayed until November 1st. But the changes in copayments are effective today.
That was KEYF's Matthew Moore reporting. nonprofit focused on supporting creatives in Arkansas, has a new mission. Arkansas Originals is preparing to embark on a new project, the Delta River Blues Trail, honoring the people and places behind the state's musical heritage. KASU's Marty Scarborough spoke with the nonprofit's founder, Kat Daniels, and its board president, Billy Jeter, to learn more.
That was kind of the tipping point of like, okay, I get this. You know, they have this entrepreneurial spirit that is tied to their heritage here in Arkansas. And, you know, the people who are making music, specifically with blues, you know, they were entrepreneurs. They were developing their own identity, their own sound. And it made way for a future lineage of the music industry and blues. And so it kind of all came together very quickly when all these things sort of, you know, connecting the dots. And Billy and I have worked together, and he brought up the idea of the trail. And he's of like mind and heart too, of, you know, telling these stories and sharing. And I'm like, we have a chance. I was thinking about, you know, kicking off a nonprofit, and it just kind of, the niche just kind of happened, and it just naturally, as it should for the natural state. And I'm, you know, just so, so excited. We've had great traction, very big interest in all of it, specifically the trail. It's like everybody's like, finally, you know, we get to learn and see more about this. And the people who know so much, they're all, you know, they're just excited. So I'm glad that we're getting a chance to share it.
And Billy, I want to kind of pivot now to that project, the Delta River Blues Trail. Could you give us the kind of the big idea concept behind that?
Yeah, it's a big idea with a big name and a lot of words. And we understand that, but that the name kind of encompasses what we're trying to do with this. We couldn't figure out a word to cut out of that. So it's a big, long name. But really what we're trying to do, and this all started, as you know, Marty, my last album I came out, I had the Arkansas native Bobby Rush play harmonica on a song called Hambone Stomp. And that song has, with Bobby Rush, opened doors to me all over the world. I have listeners all over the world every day, and I have people that will absolutely know me and where I'm from because Bobby Rush opened that door. So I started thinking, man, how can I pay a guy back who doesn't need paying back? Bobby still is 91 years old and plays all over the world. And I thought, you know, I drive from Little Rock to my pecan orchard in a Shady Grove pecan orchard in Wabasica. And I go through Sherrill, Arkansas, and I drive through Sherrill, Arkansas, and I don't see a reference to a guy that there from, I think, 5 years old, almost 20 years old, where his formative times was, where he took a wire on the side of a barn and made him a guitar on the side of the barn from there. And there's not a single reference in that town or the plantation that he grew up on. And then I, in my travels back and forth, I go through Marvel into Helena, and I see the Levon Helm Highway and all the wonderful things that have done for Levon. And these are comparable type musicians. Along the way doing this, I wrote a song called Rose's Shack. And it's a song about the musicians around the circle around Wabasica, the center of the music universe, my hometown. And I sing about those guys and girls in that song. And invariably, when I go play that song, somebody comes up to me and says, hey, did you know about John Smith that played under this tree over here? And it just built on itself. And I started digging deep and looking at some of these names. I went and bought Jimmy Cunningham's book, Musicians of the Lowlands and Actors. I think that's it. And it's a great book by Jimmy Cunningham from Pine Bluff. And went through some of the names. And there's a guy named Roy Lee Jones from Umphrey, Arkansas, 5 miles from where I grew up. I'd never heard of. So I started listening to his songs. And I go, damn, this guy's really, really good. And then you go down the rabbit hole, and it leads to Vernon Garrett, who was a guy that has kind of a cross. We thought he was from Cornerstone, but it turns out he's from between Sherrill and Tucker. He's the guy that's kind of a cross between Bobby Rush and Al Green. And you just keep finding and finding these, and it's built on itself. I then go to Clarksdale and get invited to play at the Bluesberry Cafe in Clarksdale. We're sitting in there on a Sunday morning, and the place probably has 40 people in it. Half of the people aren't even from America. So they have flown in to see all these blues people that Mississippi has grabbed and said for their own and now have a huge tourism industry. So from there, I go back and think of who I've got that can help me. The first person, obviously, is Kat for organizational skills. The second thing is I need two different people on each end of a trail to help me, and Jimmy Cunningham in Port City Blues in Pine Bluff and Stephanie White, the mayor of Keough, are perfect places to book in this kind of trail. And we just have started built it out from there. But the really wonderful thing about this is, and the story that doesn't need missing is, I come from the Plantation Society in the Arkansas River Delta. Bobby Rush comes from the Sharecrop Society. And that guy's done everything he could do to help me for no reason this. So this is something to recognize the people here that have not been recognized in this area. And it starts with Bobby Rush and Big Bill Bronzy, and then Brunzy, and then goes on from there.
And it's interesting that some of the ones that you've chosen are, you know, there's so many blues musicians with connections to the state of Arkansas. It seems to me that you've chosen some of the ones that maybe haven't gotten as much recognition as others who, you know, who were maybe born in Mississippi but really started their careers here in Arkansas. I'm thinking people like Howlin' Wolf and Sonny Boy Williamson. Sure. They're left off your list, and you've chosen some of those lesser known. Was that the intent?
Well, yes and no. To start with, Howlin' Wolf is, we focused on a specific area, and this is really important. We focused on the Arkansas River Delta, not the Arkansas Delta. So we focused from that level of agriculture, silty loam land that starts basically in north at the edge of North Little Rock, a little bit over a Sweet Home down to Woodson on the other side of the river, and goes down to Raydale, then jumps over to Pine Bluff and goes down almost to Arkansas City. So we focus specifically on those that area. So that cuts out some of the people. And you're always going to have historically, the more blues artists are in and around the Mississippi River and the Arkansas River, but you'll have sporadic people like Willie Cobbs from Small and places like that, or Sister Rosetta Thorpe from Cotton Plant. But we wanted to have ours a focus where people could leave either Little Rock or Pine Bluff and go visit up and down in a day, stay at some of these bed and breakfasts or hotels along the way here, go out and visit these little communities up and down the Arkansas River Delta. So that's the reason we didn't have Howlin' Wolf and people on there. And everybody is not an older type guy. We've got a guy in Pine Bluff Joe Pitts, that plays guitar for people all over the world that people know about, but don't have the recognition that a lot of people do. So we're working really hard up and down a narrow corridor to identify people that have made a difference in this area.
That was Billy Jeter, board president of Arkansas Originals, joined by the nonprofit's founder, Kat Daniels. They spoke with KASU's Marty Scarborough. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.